Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk. With me today are Austin Bay and Jim Dunnigan. Austin is an author, columnist, blogger, and contributor to StrategyPage.com. Jim is a military analyst, consultant for the U.S. military, and well-known author. On Strategy Talk, we discuss current events with our own unique twist. We report news as history. Welcome, Jim and Austin. Today we'd like to talk a little bit about Russia and what Russia's been doing and some of their problems and issues. Jim, you wrote a little article about them naming one of their new subs after Santa Claus. That was sort of a humorous thing.
Yeah, well, that was done mostly for humor. I mean, it's true. The fourth sub of their new Boré-class SSBNs, missile-carrying subs, is going to be named St. Nicholas, which in Russia is actually the patron saint of sailors. We referenced in the article that it's the patron saint of drowning men, which could be construed as the same thing if you're in the Russian Navy. But the Russians have bigger problems than, you know, Santa Claus naming a nuclear submarine after Santa Claus. The big news this week isn't at a Strategy Page. It's out of Poland and Russia, where there's that big, well, not a shouting match, not a shooting match this time, over the festivities, as it were, the commemoration of the 70th anniversary of the start of World War II. Now, all the concerned countries, including Poland, of course, and the Western countries, especially France and Britain, we're going to hold various, you know, ceremonies to commemorate this momentous event. But then out of Russia, which is now in possession of basically a state-controlled mass media, you started hearing all these stories about how, well, maybe it wasn't, you know, Germany's fault as much. Maybe the Poles really started World War II, and it went downhill from there. What the Russians were trying to do was basically deflect any attention being paid to their role in the events of 1939, when as the Germans invaded Poland from the west, the Russians came in and took the eastern part, because that was all part of the pact that the Russians and Poles, the Russians and Germans had signed just a month before, in which they secretly divided up Europe between them, temporarily as far as Stalin was concerned, because he was already planning on invading Russia. The Russians are now, after 70 years of practice, still rewriting history, or at least trying to. And they just came up with a whole bunch of stuff, and it got to the point where Putin, the prime minister, former president of Russia, former KGB man, he wrote an article in which he basically apologized to the Poles. He says all this, without going into details, he basically, the bottom line was, the soundbite was, Poland was the victim. And Russia did some things, you know, they shouldn't have done, or words to that effect. Maybe that's not strongly. But he basically disowned all the crap that was coming out from the ultra-nationalists and the old-timers in Russia, which I thought was a great, you know, recovery, because Russia was really headed down into a bottomless pit of scorn and opprobrium, you know, for coming out with those kind of stories, you know, straight out of Stalin's playbook, you know, at a time like this. They even tried to accuse the Germans of being partly responsible for the Katyn massacre. That's where the 1940, the Russians rounded up 40,000 of the most, the best and the brightest, shall we say, of the Poles, and executed them and buried them. And until quite recently, until late in the Cold War, Russia steadfastly blamed this on the Germans. But, of course, the Poles in the vicinity knew it was the Russians that did it. And then, you know, it became an open secret. And finally, I think only in 1990, after the Cold War ended, I think the Russians finally fessed up and said, yeah, it was us. So there's a lot of history going on, you know, this week concerning Russia. And a lot of it, unfortunately, has to do with history possibly, well, not possibly, definitely repeating itself, and possibly repeating itself even more down the road.
Right. I wonder if they're going to have two celebrations, one where, hey, we helped start World War II, and then a little celebration a little bit longer, hey, the Germans invaded us.
Well, I think that's what's actually happening inside Russia. You can go to either party, depending on your preference.
Right. Well, now, with some of the things that, you know, history stretching forward into time, we have all those small states now surrounding Russia again.
Yes, and the Russians want them back. This is something else that's happening in Russia, and it's interesting. Putin's little editorial was refreshing and reassuring in a way, because the way things have been going in Russia, the people in charge have been playing to the imperialists, so to speak, in Russia. The people who want Russia to be a superpower again, who want to, you know, because basically what happened was it took Russia 400 years to put that empire together, where, you know, they had Belarusia, they had Ukraine, they had the Central Asian states, the Baltic states, and the damn Soviet bureaucrats, you know, lost it a couple of weeks in 1991. That's a shock. A lot of Russians have not really gotten over again, and it's become a sort of a popular meme. You know, if it's a slow news day, just talk about, you know, what happened to the empire, who lost the empire, you know, how do we get it back? And that is still popular, and I don't know, you know, it's like the Palestinians, Arabs, you know, with all their anti-Israel propaganda, Israel doesn't exist, it must be destroyed. How do you reverse that? And so Putin's little editorial might be, you know, I mean, he might go down in history, he's accomplished some things, but he might possibly go down in history as the guy who weaned Russians off the idea of empire.
Yeah, when they talk about empire, they're not talking about the communist state coming back. They just are looking at
the Russian empire. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, because the communists simply picked up, you know, what the Tsar had already conquered. They were latecomers to the party. Most of the work, all the heavy lifting basically had been done by the Tsar. While they condemned the Tsar, they were certainly grateful because they inherited the secret police, you know, the empire, the civil service, all sorts of things. I mean, the history of Russia, of the Soviet period, has really not been written yet because the Russians have not come to grips with the reality of what they've lived through. There was a short period, a few years in the early 90s, where you could go in there, if you had enough cash, you could get into just about any archives, and some historians did. Then the KGB realized, holy crap, we got a lot of stuff in here, dirty linen, we don't want out. And they just slammed shut the doors again.
As Ted Kennedy found out.
Yeah, oh yeah, well, a lot of unpleasant, you know, secrets, you know, were revealed in that short period of sunshine. But that really has to be opened up again, and, you know, all that dirty linen has to come out, you know, and let the chips fall where they may. And the Russians have to admit that, you know, we went through a hell of a situation, and unless we, you know, confront it and, you know, admit that a lot of us, or our ancestors, our parents, grandparents, whatever, were complicit in a lot of this crap, you know, we're just headed for a redo, and nobody in the right mind wants to go through that again.
Right.
Not another 70 years of the Soviet Empire.
Now, Austin, you sort of brought that up in your article this week on Point that we're going to repeat history if we're not careful.
Well, that was I wrote two columns in a row, Dan, both touching on the beginning of World War II, and really that first one, of which was more focused on the history, Hitler-Stalin Pact, Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, whatever you want to call it. It's called both. It's called a Nazi-Soviet pact too. In some annals, it was the week before last. To date it on the site, it's an On Point, and it's the Hitler-Stalin Pact, and I talk a little bit about communazis, which
right.
was a term. Oh, a soundbite term in the era before soundbites, so I guess it would have been called a newspaper quip, that became current use in the media after the revelation of the Hitler-Stalin Pact, because there you had Europe's two great totalitarian movements, the National Socialists and the Communists, openly and complicitly allied. And then, as Jim said a minute ago, there were a lot of little secret protocols about divvying up Eastern Europe, to include divvying up Poland, which what was it? It depends on how you measure it, 7 days, 8 days, 9 days after the Hitler-Stalin Pact is signed. There's some that say it's signed on August 23rd, 1939. Others it's published August 24th, 1939. But those are the little battles of footnotes that that people have. But definitely, Poland and Germany. Germany is attacking Poland really late on the night of August 31st, 1939. So the the communazi became the term that brought these both. And this is the thing, they're both, if you want to look at it in left-right terms, left-wing movements of a type. They're socialists,
right.
National socialists versus kind of an international socialist. But at the same time, and I think Jim alluded to this a moment ago in his discussion of the Russians losing their empire and then the imperialists that are still extant in Russia at the time, that Vladimir Putin pitches a lot of his, at least his rhetoric towards. They were both empires. One was a German empire reinvigorated by Adolf Hitler and his Nazi ideology, and the other one, as Jim said, the communists wake up and they found that they've inherited a lot, not all, a lot of what the Tsars had. Go back to 1914, most of parts of then Romania were inside the Tsar's influence, sphere of influence, Moldova, Bessarabia, and that was something that the secret protocols of the Hitler-Stalin Pact gave parts of interwar between World War I and World War II Romania to the Soviet Union, and that was the province of Bessarabia, which is now Moldova, which is, if you follow strategy page and where we write about Moldova on the Balkans, it's still split. There's a kind of a Romanian element, most of the state of Moldova, and then Transdniester Republic, a statelet that is heavily Russified and ethnic Russian. And I'm not drawing a straight line through the pointing straight at the Hitler-Stalin Pact. Is that the deeper history over that the battles over that province between? Between empires and states, it was certainly part of what was at stake in that pact. But there you have the Russian Empire and this burgeoning German Empire dividing up bits of Eastern Europe, and we still have are living with the effects of the echoes of the Hitler-Stalin Pact, and certainly through World War II. Is Russia out to recover? I think this is something that Jim alluded to a moment ago, out to try to recover its empire. I don't think so, but I certainly think it's asserting a sphere of influence. We saw that in Georgia. And the Hitler-Stalin Pact was an assertion of spheres of influence. If you're going to split Poland up, there's going to be this German influence area, sphere of influence Poland, and then the Russians are coming into the eastern part, which they say is taking back, what was it, Jim, parts of western Ukraine that were lost.
Right after World War II, they rearranged all that.
Yeah, well, I know they have World War II, but I'm talking about after World War I when Poland comes back. I mean, whatever the Tsarist influence on...
Well, the partition was still in play back then in World War I.
Yeah.
Poland didn't exist, and it was after... After World War I that that's something else the Russians are still angry about, the way they were defeated in their attempts to reconquer Poland. They thought that was unfair for various reasons.
Oh, after World War I, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. You know, Pilsudski and all that. They were not happy about that.
I think there's something else I'll pick up on just briefly, Dan, trying to... And I was pointing just at Moldova. There are other issues, and Jim's pointing out here the existence of Poland as perhaps a problem, maybe a big problem for Russian imperialists. It's that collaboration between the so-called left and right. They really have a lot of similarities. And as I know that Jim's mentioned this before, the European left, Euro leftists, seeming to sympathize greatly with Islamo-fascists, and certainly at a rhetorical level. And it's not quite the same, in my view, as a Hitler-Stalin alliance. But there's certainly echoes of it. Jim, do you think that's the case?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. A lot of the attitudes are still there. And we're only upset when they bubble to the surface, which they're doing right now.
Well, and there's a great refusal to recognize this because, they're both totalitarian movements, and they're after state control. And what they see in the Islamo-fascists, I suppose, is a curious kind of state control that they identify with.
Well, they see fellow revolutionaries, people who are going to things are done. Yeah, although, as a practical matter, the Islamo-fascists are all about returning to the way things used to be done.
About the 11th century, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, one of the problems, other than all the small states that Russia's dealing with around its borders, and then also states that are wanting to continue the break-off, is their eroding infrastructure. I have been told that they're having a very, very hard time, other than oil and gas, of getting their natural resources out of the different areas that they're in.
Yeah, we did another article on that about the Russian, budgetary problems. That again goes back to the 70 years of communism. They never got into proper accounting. They never knew exactly how much they were spending on anything. And this came out before the Cold War ended. I mean, I remember, when the CIA would invite me down from time to time to, discuss issues like this. This is before the Cold War ended. And they'd mentioned that, they have American academics or negotiators or whatever the case, especially in the 1980s, they were negotiating some disarmament deals. But they would, their experts would talk to their experts. And their experts were more and more openly complaining about the lack of reliable numbers on, what was going on inside of Russia. I mean, the joke, and it wasn't really a joke in the CIA, was that their arms negotiators would always come over and ask for, what are your numbers and what we've got? And more than once, the Russians would admit, especially if everybody was talking in Russian, which, the CIA guys could do, they say, look, our stuff is shit, your stuff is much better than the crap, we're trying to work from. And, of course, the Americans were appalled, but the Russians, having lived with that for decades, this sloppy, whatever the center, the people at the top say do, just do it, and don't bother me about details or facts or anything like that. And the Russians have not really recovered from that. They still don't know what is going on or how much damage has been done. I mean, one of the problems with not having accountants around, and let's hear it for the accountants, is that you don't know what kind of trouble you are in. You can't fix a problem you don't know you have. Of course, Russia discovered they had a lot of problems in the early 90s when the whole thing started collapsing around and said, gee, Yvonne, something's wrong. The electricity doesn't work, the heat doesn't work, the railroads are all broken. Something's not right. They sort of scrambled, as the Russians are wont to do. And again, this is another, joke. You Russians like to joke about this. There was recently a joke about the space station, about the Russian guy up there, he said, they'll get things fixed, but they do it differently. They'll improvise. Improvising doesn't bother them at all. They consider that normal. So when he says, in a way, always have a Russian with you up there in a space station because you can't FedEx over special parts. You need somebody who's really good at scrambling and putting things together. But the Russians have found that only takes them so far. And what's happening now, and they are paying a lot more attention to, cost accounting and engineering inspections and just keeping track of, exactly what shape they're in, because the infrastructure got no investment or very little investment as the economy started falling apart in the 80s. Money was just shifted around to wherever, it seemed to be needed most. And a lot of stuff just got cut off. You see the same thing in the United States when the politicians are involved. You know, a lot of parts of the country have bridges that were not given proper maintenance because the money was needed elsewhere, and now you got bridges falling down. New York City went through that in the 70s and 80s before we got religion and a law that mandated that we pay attention in the city. But the Russians are only still making their way through this, and they have a lot of problems, and they don't like to talk about it because, let's face it, it's embarrassing. It's basically on a national level admitting that, you know, we couldn't run a nation properly. And they hate that because they consider themselves very, you know, cultured, cultrini, very high-class people. Well, a lot of them are, but unfortunately a lot of them aren't, and those are the ones who tend to be running the country.
Right. Now, their Navy is having some specific problems in that basically they've got a lot of rusting holes, correct?
Well, there again was this decision where they made a decision based more on what they'd like to have than what they could have. In other words, at the end of the Cold War, they had the second largest fleet in the world. And a lot of them were fairly new ships, because their ships don't last that long. The admirals had to decide, well, do we immediately mothball 90% of the ships, which is what they should have done? You know, basically just scrap them, you know, get crews off them. I mean, just don't pay attention to them anymore. And try and keep the 10% of the best, the newest and what have you, you know, in some kind of shape so we can actually use them. We have full crews and everything. Or do we try and keep as many ships as possible in commission? Well, obviously they made the wrong decision. They tried to keep as many ships, and so they had fewer ships that could actually go to sea or do anything. And they're only coming to grips with. I mean, it's got so bad that they were secretly towing out, you know, they had over 200 nuclear submarines. The largest number of nuclear submarines in the world ever built are Russian. And they're all mostly crap. And they were secretly taking them out into the Arctic Sea and just scuttling them, just sinking them. Say, well, that one's gone, never existed. Until the Norwegians, you know, a Norwegian survey ship or somebody caught, you know, said, what's all that radiation down there? But they were sinking them with the reactors still in there.
Oh, gosh.
Because that's how else are you going to, it's too expensive to take them apart. That's the way you're supposed to, dispose of a nuclear submarine. So now they're being subsidized so they can properly get rid of over 200 nuclear submarines. The rest of them they can just scrap, you know, and make a few bucks on that. But they didn't start doing that until the last decade. So they went for a decade in crab cuckoo land. They did it throughout the armed forces, and now in the last in this century, shall we say, they are now planning for a much smaller armed forces. We did an article last year pointing out how they made themselves very unpopular with their officer corps by basically laying off a third of the officers. They say, we don't need all you guys. Because what the whole military did after the Cold War ended, they immediately lost most of their soldiers because they couldn't afford to even maintain conscripts who were paid, you know, $5 a month and room and board. And of course, they lost half their population, or nearly half, yeah, about half their population with the other states falling off. They said, but most of the officers were always Russian. So they had about a third of them, over half of the military was officers. And they just kept them. They said, well, we can't get rid of all these officers. Of course, why not? And Western advisors were telling them, you don't need all these officers. Most of them are just, you know, doing nothing, shuffling paper. Well, they finally did that. So they're only now, as we speak, carrying out decisions they should have made back in 1991, 18 years ago. So that's the kind of problem they have. The next problem is, can they rebuild as much of the infrastructure that they need? The railroads are in bad shape. They still haven't got that many roads.
Right.
And, of course, the electricity. They have pollution. They have problems with water management, despite all the water they have. They just got a huge pile of problems. And people who invest over there, these are the people I talk to, who think of investing over there, they say, you know, the jury's still out on whether or not they're going to be able to, you know, fix a lot of these problems without having a big mess, you know, a whole bunch of big messes, you know, show up in the headlines, you know, before they can clean it all up.
Dan, I would add something to that. What Jim said, to put it in another frame, is he's described a lot of traditional, classic infrastructure problems Russia has faced throughout its history. Lack of roads, so erratic communications. Now, I mean, they've got plenty of quote unquote, you know, radio, TV, internet communications now, but it's a question of distance. But the situation that Russia in the early 21st century faces is that they've got a version of those lack of infrastructure problems, compounded by the environmental damage, pollution, unrest, the environmental damage and pollution from the 80 years of communism, unrest on the periphery, a few of the peripheral states have had good relationships with Moscow over the centuries. Most of them haven't, and they also face really declining a population. Russia's got a large number of HIV cases. We touched on this several years ago on a strategy page post about the alcoholism. That's always been a Russian problem, but the loss of the empire in that decade between 1991 and 2001, you started getting statistics really on how bad it was. So they've got a post-imperial hangover that is really they've got population and demographic issues out of it. So it's a tough problem for any government in Moscow to address the infrastructure needs and the demographic issues.
Now, basically, Austin, they've, because of all these problems, they basically have stopped any power projections into other continents other areas.
No. I think they want to project. They've got, let's go back to the sphere of influence.
Right.
They believe they all have a sphere of influence. Georgia is an example of that. Part of their sphere of influence is, you know, it's like that section that we had several years ago on Strategy Page, Wars in the Near Abroad. That certainly picked up in the fourth edition of A Quick and Dirty Guide to War. We even had some of that in the third edition from 1996. Those are sphere of influence, czarist, and I talk czarist sphere of influence, Stalinist sphere of influence, and they have the ability with their as limited resources, they still have firepower to project on the periphery, on the Russian geographical area. Don't forget
right.
that they have nuclear missiles as well, ballistic missiles with nuclear weapons, and that is a huge, powerful chip. At the same time, they don't have to look over their shoulder. It's really right in their front yard. They have several front yards. One of them is Siberia. China looks at Siberia and thinks the Tsar took it from them, or certainly vast stretches of it. How do they hold it? I've said this several times in other venues, and it sounds pretty darn radical. But Russia, at some point, I think, is going to a responsible Russian government is going to look to the West and say, you know, if we're going to hold Siberia, we need defense relationships with Western Europe, with Germany, with France, with Great Britain. Why? With the United States and Canada, because that's the choice is Siberia going to fall under China's sphere of influence? Part of it perhaps picked up by Japan. I don't know. I'm being very futuristic.
Well, that's when Russia joins NATO.
I'm sorry?
That's when Russia joins NATO.
That's right, Jim. And I Dunnigan's aware of this discussion, and there was a column I wrote this summer, as a matter of fact, that commented on the quote unquote the Obama administration's approach to dealing with Russia, and I had that included in one of the paragraphs, which is Russia's going to look west because it needs defense backup. When does that happen?
Yeah.
I don't know. It sure doesn't look like it's going to happen now with Vladimir Putin, but 10 years, 8 years. If they wait 20 years, it may be too late.
But they're no longer trying to, other than Iran, they're not mucking around a lot down in the Middle East or Africa. They've tried to do some things in Venezuela with Chavez, but other than that, you know, basically they're staying out of South America.
Well, they tried to sell in a lot of crummy weapons. So that's
yeah.
why they succeeded at that.
Right.
They would like to do a lot of things, but as Austin points out, they simply can't afford it. So what they look for is how can we make a buck? And selling cheap weapons always works.
Right. And they've got a lot of those in storage.
Well, they're selling new stuff. But they want to keep those factories operating because a lot of them have gone out of business and many more are still hanging on by their fingernails.
Right.
So they have an economic incentive. But if they can get a diplomatic and ego boo, you know, a bump on top of that, they're more than happy to do it. I mean, making friends with somebody like Chavez, you know, brings back all sorts of warm, fuzzy Cold War memories.
Now, they have been trying to refurb some of their older stuff, though, haven't they, Jim, and selling that off to some of the poorer countries?
Not really. A lot of the old weapons that came out of Russia were smuggled out and sold on the black market. And that's the reason why so many millions of people are dying in Africa, because of all those old AK-47s. They have been building a lot of new stuff. They have been trying to make money. They have been making some money by refurbishing old Soviet-era equipment that they sold to somebody like India, for example, by installing, in any cases, Western electronics. I mean, they'll install Russian, they prefer to install Russian electronics, but if the customer wants an Italian, you know, fire control computer, they're more than happy to oblige. There's big money in upgrading old Russian, you know, aircraft and even warships because the stuff is cheap. It will do its basic job. A lot of countries really can't afford to buy, you know, this fancy Western stuff. But all they really need is, you know, to help with the Coast Guard or to fight their equally poverty-stricken neighbor. And in cases like that, Russian stuff is perfectly adequate. And if we can upgrade it so it'll last another 10 years, even better. So Russians are hustling. Russians have become businessmen.
Right.
You know, politics doesn't figure as much in their military, sales decisions as it used to. These days, they're not giving as much credit as they used to back in the Soviet period. They only started giving credit again fairly recently. For a long time, and throughout the 1990s, it was cash. If you had cash, we'll sell you. Otherwise, you know, maybe the Americans will give you terms. But now they've been quite successful. They've been selling about six, I think last couple of years, they've been doing like $8 billion a year. That's a big business for them. They'd like to keep it going. But as far as the diplomatic, clout they used to wield in the Middle East and other parts of the world, forget it. It just isn't there.
Right.
They're not even pretending anymore.
Right. So basically, if we were to sum everything up, they've got a long haul ahead of them.
Yes, and they just realized how screwed up they were. It took them over a decade to realize, hey, we're screwed up.
And to Austin's point, what the United States should probably be doing is trying to strengthen relationships because in the end, we both have some of the similar fears. Islam is going to be a challenge for them, as is a growing China.
Exactly. And most of the most interesting discussions we have had with Russia, the country, have been off the record. The minute you go on the record, you get all sorts of stuff. You know, you get Russians, get all the Russian, various Russian political parties. I mean, they do have a democracy over there, and they still have some independent media. But people start jumping up and down with their, hey, let's bring the empire back. Hey, don't disrespect us and what have you. So there's been a lot of useful stuff going on, as I've been told, very quietly, saying, look, we can help you, you know, sort out your budget, the national budget, the federal budget. We can give you some help. They quietly send some of their bureaucrats over here, you know, to visit state governments. I mean, hell, California, I think, has a bigger GNP than all of Russia does. Although, at this point, you wouldn't want to study how they run this state financially.
Right.
But there are a lot of, we have 50 states, and some of them are fairly well run. And we unabashedly bring the Russians, sometimes the Russians hear about it themselves, and they will come over and say, we'd like to see how things are done. I think Wisconsin is fairly well run.
Well,
Dan?
Yeah.
Let me make one. Let me make a point off of what Jim is saying there, and I think it kind of rounds out some of the discussion too. Russia does have a great deal of rhetorical bluster. I've written this. I think all the griping about putting ground-based interceptors as part of the U.S. missile shield in Poland and objecting to control centers and radar in the Czech Republic and some of the other things right there is just it's Cold War rhetoric that appeals to, as Jim calls them, the imperialists and also to a degree of Russian pride, because those GBIs are not a threat to Russia. They're not a threat to Russian missiles. They're there to provide a thin shield to Iran, and it's probably, I would say it is, in Russia's interest that Mad Mullahs have an element of doubt should they decide to throw a ballistic missile at some of Russia's greatest customers, which are Central and Western Europe. That's just not in Moscow's interest. Russia has this rhetorical belligerence, this rhetorical echoes or memory of a Cold War, and I see that as for really the domestic consumption. What's sad is to see some Western governments sit there and say, "Oh, well, we need to do this for the Russians," when really, what you need to do is, at some level, recognize that Russian pride matters to them, but press on, press forward, and say, "Look, this is in our mutual interest. You guys really know it." But unfortunately, that's not where it appears U.S. and Western Russian policy is at the moment.
Yes, and that's a good place for us to stop. Our time's run out, and we will see you gentlemen next week.
Till then, bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, guys. Bye.